This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we have a busy one. We'll talk about John Meacham, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. Pulitzer Prize winner takes a look at the third United States president and all the controversies that have swirled about Jefferson in recent years. Also, Jimmy Weatherford, owner of Louis for 35 years, and Beth Zagurski on the Northgate Fest this week at the gates of Louisiana State University. Kimberly Levy-Marcel will stop by to discuss volunteers in public schools. Big week for VIPs in this community. And we'll take a look at Saturday's game, Alabama hosting LSU. The Crimson Tide, number one, defending national champs, 11-point favorites over the Fighting Tigers of Leslie Edwin Miles. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. J.C. Kane is producing. Your numbers are 877-217-5757. And in the city, please call 297-5633. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Just a bit, we'll talk more about LSU's looming date Saturday in Tuscaloosa against Alabama. The Crimson Tide going for their third consecutive national championship and their fourth BCS title in 5 years under Nick Saban, who won a BCS title at LSU 10 years ago. Alabama undefeated, ranked number one as an 11-point favorite over LSU, despite the fact that LSU won there 2 years ago in a memorable overtime bout, 9-6, and Les Miles also won in Tuscaloosa in 2007 and in 2005. So he is 3-1 in 4 games at Bryant-Denny Stadium. This is a big week at the gates of LSU, even though a lot of action is going on in Tuscaloosa, and it's the annual Northgate Festival. How many years, Jimmy?
Oh, it's been 9 years.
9 years.
Mm-hmm. It's our ninth year.
That's the voice of Jimmy Weatherford, the owner of Louis. This week he's celebrating his 35th anniversary as the owner of Louis Cafe.
On that date, in fact, November 8th.
November 8th. Right. Mm-hmm. The day that Tom Dempsey kicked his 63-yard field goal to beat the Detroit Lions in 1970.
Yeah.
But Louis has been around since 1941, but you've been at your location since 1986.
That's correct. I was on Chime Street at the old building from 78. Louis actually was downtown for a few years around 1938, but then he moved to Chime Street in 1941.
You've had many famous people who have stopped by at Louis, including Les and Kathy Miles. They've eaten there. Some big-name actors through the years have been to Louis. Sean Penn, for example, I know he
had. Yeah, John Goodman.
Willem Dafoe, who wasn't either.
Oh, yeah.
And many others.
Yeah.
Many others.
Sure.
Great athletes, of course. Shaquille O'Neal and Bill Walton. And one Politico that we know of, I'm sure there have been many others, but Hubert Horatio Humphrey, vice president under Lyndon Baines Johnson. He was a graduate of LSU class of 1940 and stopped by at Louis and when it was on Chime Street, of course. And history says that HHH, the man who was almost president, almost beat Dick Nixon in 1968, he bounced a check at Louis.
That's the legend, Jim. Yeah. Louis, if you mention Hubert Humphrey to Louis Sisk, you'd get an earful. He was mad about that.
Yeah. Was Frenchie waiting on Hubert Humphrey back in those days?
Oh, I'm sure he was. Yeah. No. But Frenchie has been at Louis for 23 or 4 years.
Yeah. He's been on the show a few times.
Yeah.
He might even be listening right now. Now, Jimmy Weatherford is a man about town, and we've spoken. I don't know if you've ever actually been on the show, but we've spoken about you. You're immortalized in film with Schizopolis, right?
Oh, yes. I had a small part in that.
Mm-hmm. Jimmy opens and closes that film, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that is correct.
Yeah. Now, how did you get into that?
Oh, just my friend David Jensen, friend of Steven Soderbergh, and I know Steven too when he lived in Baton Rouge, and They just called me up and asked me if I wanted to be in the movie. I said, sure.
And you see a lot of Jimmy in the movie.
Yeah.
You do. David Jensen's another one who's been at Louis. Recently he was there. And he even gave me a couple of copies of Raymond Strother's books, which I really appreciated. I lost my copy of Falling Up, so thanks to David Jensen for taking care of me while he was having an omelet one morning with John Meese, mm-hmm. who was there with him. Now, the Northgate Festival, 9 years. What happens this weekend on November 8th?
Well, I'm going to let Beth talk a little bit about it.
Beth is Beth Zagurski, and you were involved intricately in this, but... before we get to Beth, what are you going to be doing, particular?
Louis will have we'll have a booth. We'll have some great gumbo and potato salad, bread pudding, hash browns. Other restaurants will be there. Serrano's will be out there. Reginelli's, the Chimes, Inga's. Who else, Beth?
Wow. Well, along with the Northgate merchants, there'll also be some food trucks. So we'll have Three Bones Catering out there and Taco De Baco to help bring, a little bit more variety into the street and the festival. We have artists, over 20 booths, I believe, mm-hmm. so local artisans, anything from jewelry to pottery. And then, of course, we have music. And that's the big thrust, I think, of the Northgate Fest is to highlight up-and-coming bands, musical talent in Baton Rouge.
All right, that brings us to a question here.
Yeah.
What's happened to the Bayou? Is it shut down? Not the Bayou, the library. That caller or the listener.
Oh,
yeah, the library.
They're temporarily closed, is what I understand. But they're going to get back open. So I'm not real sure.
Well, that's right there on Chime Street mm-hmm. with Clark Cadzell.
Yep.
Yes.
At Island Coffees.
Yep.
And he's been going. He's 1989, 24 years now.
That's right.
So mm-hmm. a lot of people have survived at that location in that area. And it's been up and down through the years. It hasn't always been the easiest place to operate, has it?
No. There was a period in the 90s when there were some businesses that were shuttered. But things have really come back strong now with College Row, with the businesses on Chime Street and State Street and Highland Road. There's over 20 restaurants mm-hmm. and other shops. There's a bicycle shop. There's Massey's. There's hair salons.
Yoga studio.
That complex across the street from you, though, some of us liked it better the old way with the grocery store and the movie theater. Murphy's had its charms.
Yeah. Murphy's was a great source Chelsea's of after-hour business. Yeah, Chelsea's was there in that shopping center. Inga's was there. Now, Inga is around on Chime Street now, so she's doing great there.
Well, Beth, how did you get involved in this?
Well, I actually got involved because the event organizer last year just no longer could do it. And so at the 11th hour, they pulled me in because I organize mm-hmm. another festival in town. And so I just jumped right in and did the best
I
could.
What's Friday? What time do you get started on Friday?
4 p.m.
4 p.m. this Friday, the Northgate Festival, the 9th annual festival. Jimmy will be out there with all the troops from Louis, and all the businesses are involved. It's a big affair, but the LSU football team will be in Tuscaloosa at the time the festival begins. Les Miles, by the way, celebrates his birthday the day after the Alabama game. He turned 60 on Sunday.
Is
I'm sure he'll
right?
be celebrating at Louis.
I hope so.
Sunday morning, right?
Frenchie will make him something special.
Yeah. Well, he upset Alabama 2 years ago, beat the odds, and now LSU is an 11-point underdog to the Crimson Tide Saturday in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. But we wish you well at the Northgate Fest. And generally, I mean, thousands of people show up. It's a big thing.
It is. It's a lot of fun. It looks like the weather's going to be good, and it's a free festival. You can get information on our website, which is northgatesoflsu.com, but you can just Google Northgates and it'll bring you
Northgates
of
LSU.com.
LSU.
Okay, well, thank you, Jimmy. Thank you, Beth. Good luck, and good to see you.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Okay, and if you haven't seen Schizopolis, you could see Jimmy Weatherford. J.C. Kane is pumped about this weekend. LSU trying to get back in the hunt for the SEC West Championship. And in order for the Tigers to win, a lot of dominoes have to fall. LSU has to beat Alabama. Then probably Auburn has to beat Alabama later. And then Georgia would have to beat Auburn. And all those things would have to happen, and LSU would have to win the remainder of its games with Alabama, Texas A&M, and Arkansas. But first things first, LSU and Tuscaloosa against the former coach, Nick Luz Saban, who was featured on 60 Minutes last night, a puff piece, but the guy has won four national championships, so there's a lot to promote when it comes to Nick Saban. But Armin Katayan, who was on this show not long ago, talked about how people don't like Saban, and Saban's response was that mediocre people don't like high achievers, and high achievers don't like mediocre people. And I think the follow-up question would have been, who are the mediocre people you're talking about, Coach? But I don't think that question was asked. But when he was at LSU, mind you, Saban arrived here in 1999 at the end of the season, right before the turn of the century. He was 48 years old. LSU had had eight losing seasons in 11 years, and immediately he turned things around. And within 2 years, LSU was an SEC champion. Within 4 years, the Tigers had won the BCS championship under Nick Saban. And he was always intense, as we know, and at press conferences that was evidenced. Here's a sampling of Mr. Saban a few years into his tenure about how things were going as far as the progress that he had envisioned off the field. J.C. Kane, do we have Coach Saban? I don't hear him. So, see if we can do a little better and see if we can get Coach Saban. He was, of course, intense about improvements off the field that he thought were essential to success on the field. Nick Saban, in his 5 years at LSU, brought the Tigers from a 3-8 season in 1999 to...
I was told when I came here there was three things we were going to do. Improve the living conditions for the players, which we have. Build an academic support center, which we have. And the last thing we're going to do is build a football facility for football. That's what the coach was told. So if it's important to have...
Okay. I think we're going to have to go to the backup on this because the tape is obviously...
Here, then somebody ought to stand up and say...
Okay. All right. Can you stop that one and then go to the backup and maybe we can hear Coach Saban in all his glory. But as mentioned, he was 3-8. LSU was under Jerry DiNardo in 1999, and then Saban in his first year led the Tigers to an 8-4 season, a victory in a bowl game, and it was success from that point on. The second year, LSU went 10-3, won the Sugar Bowl and the SEC Championship, and the Fighting Tigers of LSU never looked back. Had winning seasons all 5 years with Saban, and of course have had winning seasons all 9 years with Les Miles, who has the best overall record of any Tiger coach. 92 wins and 23 losses for Coach Les Miles. That's 80% better than Saban was. He was 75% when he was at Louisiana State University. Now, J.C., we got a better version of Coach Saban. Here he is.
You know, it's like I always say, when did Noah build the ark? Before it started to rain. All right, so 15 or 20 years from now, everybody in Louisiana is going to want to have the same pride in their program that they have right now. And if we don't start, how can you think we can compete when Florida makes $16 million more every year because of the way they sell their tickets in their stadium than we do?
All right. That was Saban talking about ticket sales, and he made the point that LSU at that point was selling tickets for the same amount for every game, and now the Tigers vary that for the bigger opponents. Fans are charged more when they attend an LSU game. And, for example, next year you can bet the Alabama game will cost more than the others, and it should, because next year LSU will play at home New Mexico State, Sam Houston State, UL Monroe, Kentucky, Mississippi State, Ole Miss, and Alabama. Alabama for LSU has become like the Army-Navy game. It's a must-win for the Fighting Tigers, for the fans to be pleased. Saban's a guy who hasn't been liked since he returned to the Southeastern Conference at LSU's arch rival, and when he first came back in 2008 for his first game at LSU after leaving as the head coach, first game as a collegiate coach, he was burned in effigy at Tiger Manor. another Northgate business. I'm sure they'll be represented Saturday or Friday at the gates of LSU, and we'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. 877-217-5757. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. And we will talk more about LSU and Alabama as we approach Saturday, biggest game of the year, as it has been for several seasons for the Fighting Tigers. And Nick Saban is a guy who is not even mentioned when the national champs of 2003, LSU's first championship on a national level in football in 45 years, occurred 10 years ago. The team from a decade ago was honored a few weeks ago at Death Valley, and the voice of the Valley, Dan Borne, did not mention the coach, Nick Saban. He is a man who is detested by many in Baton Rouge, and then there are others who say, look, the guy built the program. Without him, LSU wouldn't be where it is. So Saban is given some grudging respect in some quarters, even though LSU fans, for the most part, would rather that he not be at the University of Alabama. Yesterday, the Saints lost to the New York Jets, and Drew Brees, of course, has been the catalyst for the Saints' success in their Super Bowl championship in February of 2010. He was about to sign with Saban in Miami. Saban had been an admirer of Drew Brees as a quarterback since Brees had played at Purdue, and Saban was the head coach at Michigan State, and Brees regularly beat the Spartans of Saban. He wanted to sign him, but he had flunked his physical, and Brees wrote about it in his autobiography. He said that he called Saban. Saban told him he had flunked the physical, and he asked him if he believed in him, and there was a pause, and at that point, Brees decided to sign with the New Orleans Saints. Now, if Brees had signed with Miami, chances are the Dolphins would have had more success. Perhaps Saban would not have gone to Alabama. LSU might have been much more successful in the SEC without Saban in the league. And, of course, the Saints quite likely would not have won their Super Bowl championship. So one phone call may have changed the course of history. And we're in touch now with Kimberly Levy Marcel. She is involved with volunteers in public schools, and this is a big week for her organization. Good morning to you, Kim Marcel.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Great.
We've had Hope
yes.
Dewan on
yes.
a few times
yes.
and others involving mm-hmm. VIPS. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the impact that VIPS has on this community as far as public education.
Mm-hmm. VIPS plays a critical role in terms of providing resources to schools and to students, primarily through our tutoring and mentoring programs. Our biggest program in terms of tutoring is Everybody Reads. So we have volunteers come in and work with students with basic reading skills and with basic math skills with Everyone Counts. So it really provides a really viable resource for teachers who can't give that one-on-one assistance to children who may not be doing as well as other students in the class.
And you've been involved for how long?
Since March. I've been involved since March.
With a fairly high-profile position.
Yes, you can say that for sure.
Well, what do you do directly, you mm-hmm. personally, with
VIPS? I am the Partners in Education Coordinator. So my role at the organization is to build and establish relationships with the business community and with nonprofit organizations, faith-based communities within EBR or public schools. And I also oversee the Voyage Program, which is our mentoring program.
What's your take on how things are going with public education right now in our community?
Well, Jim, I think that there are really great things happening in public education. But at the same time, there are some things that can be improved. But overall, you have teachers who are dedicated. You have school administrators who are dedicated to really improving public education. You know, I read somewhere that public education is the great equalizer. You know, it's a way to really prevent poverty and just improve the community overall. So I think that there are a lot of great things happening in public education. Of course, things can be improved in some areas, but overall, I think that there are some things that overall are doing well.
Got a question from a listener about the core curriculum. There's been some controversy about it, and Governor Jindal has been for it and against it, and now I think some are saying that they don't know where he stands, but he's raised some questions about it, as have others. Are those questions based on what you know? Are they valid?
Well, you know, recently I went to a Common Core training, and I had many questions about Common Core myself, and I think ultimately Common Core is supposed to bring some type of rigor to curriculums and a form of consistency. So no matter where you are in the country, you should be on the same level of learning. In terms of the inconsistencies, I really can't speak to that, but I know the intent of Common Core is to improve curriculums in the schools.
Well, there are others who are passionate saying it's got to be done, like any new thing.
Right.
It probably has some kinks.
Exactly. And I think we should just let it play itself out. I think overall it's going to be a good thing for students.
Kimberly Levy Marcel, the Partners in Education Coordinator with Volunteers in Public Schools. And tomorrow, November 5th, this is 5:30 to 7:30, there will be a presentation that you're involved with. And I think we've got the main speaker coming with us in a few minutes, but give us some more information about what will happen tomorrow evening.
Sure. We hold forums throughout the year to really inform anybody who has a stake in education, businesses, local businesses, faith-based groups, parents and teachers. We hold forums to inform the public about the latest policies and initiatives that impact public education. Tomorrow, we are so excited because we have invited Dr. Chance Lewis. He is the Carol Belk Distinguished Professor at the University of North Carolina of Urban Education. He has a wealth of knowledge in public and urban schools. He's authored over 10 books. And so he's going to be lecturing from his published work, Pursuing Extraordinary Outcomes in Public Education.
Now, are you a product of the public education system?
Yes, I
here
am.
In
yes,
this
I
community?
Am. Well, not in this community. I'm from New Orleans originally.
Where'd you go to school in New
Orleans?
To
McMaine.
Well, that's not just your run-of-the-mill public school.
No, that's
as you say, a magnet school. It's nationally recognized. Mm-hmm. How is it different from a student so it goes to a school like yours and one that's not a magnet school that may be in the inner city with all the urban issues that go with a school in an area like that?
Right. You know, that's one of the things that Dr. Lewis talks about in Pursuing Extraordinary Outcomes, is that there are some schools that may face higher population with students with exceptionalities or student retention rates. There are many schools that face challenges that hinder academic success or that may pose a challenge to academic gains and academic success. And what Dr. Lewis is saying that no matter what the environment, that we should be cultivating an arena of excellence where every student should succeed, not just the ones who are doing well or the ones who are on mark, but we should be really setting the tone where every child should be making significant academic gains, which is why we thought this piece was so important for him to come and talk about.
And we're joined by Dr. Chance Lewis, a noted author, educator. His journal that he wrote, Pursuing Extraordinary Outcomes in Public Education, will, of course, be part of the focus for his address tomorrow at 5:30 to 7:30. Now, tell us the precise location.
It's going to be at Baton Rouge Magnet High's Black Box Theater.
Okay, so that's tomorrow night.
Baton
Rouge Magnet High, Black Box Theater. Dr. Chance Lewis, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you, sir?
Doing well. Now, you have followed public education in this country, and I know you have some familiarity with Baton Rouge and where you'll be tomorrow. What are some of the distinct challenges that are evident in the public school system?
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to coming to Baton Rouge tomorrow. I'm hearing a little echo.
We can hear you.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you, Dr. Lewis.
Okay. So, coming tomorrow, Baton Rouge is a special place for me. I'm a product of Baton Rouge, graduate of Capital High School there in Baton Rouge. So I'm really excited to be a part of the forum.
What?
So, when we look at the, Go ahead. When we look at the issues surrounding urban schools, one of the things I'm excited to talk about is to really galvanize Baton Rouge toward a shared vision of what can work to work into urban schools. So one of the things I really talk about in my report are five pillars of school success that we highlight in the report. One is shared vision and collective ownership. Another is organizational persistence, transformative relationships, and really creating a climate and a culture of excellence. And finally, what I call a culturally relevant framework. These are how I'm going to frame some of my comments on tomorrow around these five pillars of success.
You went to Capital High when?
I graduated from Capital High School in 1990.
Okay, so that's 23 years. In those
yes.
23 years, have things gotten better or have they digressed?
When you look as a whole, one of the trends that I see occurring in Baton Rouge, knowing some of the history, there were many legal battles around desegregation and the consent decree there. But one of the trends I still see is that even though integration efforts were really pushed forward and made some progress, I now see the cycle has come around and we see a resegregation of the schools again without the adequate resources being provided to many of the schools. And that's one of the things that I look back and kind of troubles me from a standpoint of when we look at the great sources of the state of Louisiana and all the intellectual capital that is there, when you talk about the distribution of resources and having access to the resources for all students that attend the school system, I'm a little troubled there. But on the positive side, one of the things I do see that with increased accountability, we now have more data than we've ever had before about how students are doing, so we can shed light and really zero in where students with the most challenges need the most help. And that's one of the things that I am glad to see, that we are able to pinpoint where we can help.
2975633, a bit more time with Kimberly Levy-Marcel of she's the Partners in Education Coordinator with VIPS, and tomorrow night volunteers in public schools will be presenting a presentation with Chance Lewis. Dr. Chance Lewis is the speaker at the Baton Rouge High Black Box Theater, 5:30 to 7:00, and he is the author of Pursuing Extraordinary Outcomes in Public Education. Now, Capital High today, and probably when you were attending, Dr. Lewis, is about 100% African American. Do you think that schools in the inner city, like Capital, might not get the attention of public schools in other parts of the community?
Oh, yes, I definitely think it does happen because in every school district, including Baton Rouge, from the outside, for people who are outsiders looking in, you may say the names of certain schools and people may have a negative connotation of that particular school. But one of the things when I attended Capital and what I still know that goes on now, when you have a dedicated teaching staff, no matter what outsiders think, you can still achieve extraordinary outcomes if the school is set up correctly. And one of the things I greatly remember during that particular time, even though we did not have all of the financial resources of other schools, when we had that dedicated staff who was committed to our learning process no matter what, it was so beneficial for us. And when we look at the graduates that have come out of that particular school, including myself, if you look at outsiders' expectations of the school, there's no way a person like me would be doing what I'm doing now without dedicated staff and community members who were really pushing extraordinary outcomes for the student population at the school.
What was your academic process like after Capitol High? Where did you go from there?
I went to Southern University, majoring in education. I got my bachelor's and master's at Southern University, master's in administration and supervision and education. And I did my PhD at Colorado State University, Fort Collins, Colorado.
Very good. We have a question about the efforts in Baton Rouge to have a breakaway school system. Some mm-hmm. have remarked that this is an effort to segregate the schools. What do you think of this?
Well, when you look at, and this is one of the trends that I talk about that I think we really need to pay attention to, because down there you have a recovery school district. When recovery school district was actually put into place, the slogan at that particular time was, since the local school district is not making adequate progress with the student population, the state is going to take over and really push forward greater results. So as the state has taken over, you know, those particular schools, they have not achieved what they set out to do. So now you see a system of basically farming out these particular schools to what's going on there now through outside organizations. Many of them who are good have achieved results, but one of the things that I think that troubles me is that it seems from the outsider perspective and in the work that I do that the local school district and the recovery school district have given up on the outcomes of this particular population and put it in the hands of outside corporations or companies who do not have a local context of the student population and the community, particularly business community and other stakeholders in that area.
All right. Well, Kimberly Marcel, you are from New Orleans. Do you think the recovery school district has been a good thing?
For me personally, at the end of the day, what's important to me is that children are served and that they're able to use community resources in a way that benefits them the most. However, in saying that, I think that whatever is done, it has to be for the best intent of the student. And so if that's, again, investing more into our public school system, I think that that means everything. That means everything, because this is how children, again, can break out of poverty. They learn, they develop. And if we don't have an excellent public school system, it just hurts the community overall.
We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and on deck is the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer John Meacham. His book, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, one of the reviews, probably the best single-volume biography of Jefferson ever written. As we wrap it up with Kimberly Marcel of the Volunteers in Public Schools in this community, we thank Dr. Chance Lewis for being with us. He'll be speaking tomorrow night at Baton Rouge High, 5:30 to 7, as part of a presentation that has been produced by VIPS. But before we leave, Kimberly, I wanted you to have a chance to at least reacquaint our listeners with some of the activities that VIPS is involved with.
Absolutely. We just want to encourage everyone to go to our website, learn more about who we are, our mission, what we do, and our tutoring and mentoring programs. We still have a need for more reading friends, more math friends, particularly at our North Baton Rouge schools. they don't have as much volunteer participation as other schools do in the city, in other areas of the city. I know Progress Elementary, for instance.
Okay, so people who want to participate, what should
they do? They can go to our website, vips.ebrschools.org, or they can contact us at 226-4700. And we need more mentors for our Voyage program.
Well, thank you very much, Kimberly Levy Marcel.
Thank you.
And we're joined now by John Meacham, Pulitzer Prize winner. His book, bestseller, Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, is now in paperback. It is a voluminous account of the third president of the United States. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Jim. It is voluminous.
Yes, it is. Voluminous, and it's certainly enlightening. And you, I think, it's fair to say, as most historians do, you come away with a positive impression of Thomas Jefferson.
You do. You know, Jefferson represents the best of us and the worst of us. And I think that's one of the reasons he endures. You know, we talk more about Jefferson than we do about Washington or Hamilton or Adams. And I think that's because we recognize in him the best we can be, the promise of American liberty, but we also look at him and see the woeful shortcomings that have long shadowed the nation.
When you say the woeful shortcomings, I think we know what you're talking about.
Yeah, you know, slavery, Native American removal, a certain kind of economic power that he defended, perpetuated. There's no getting around that. He's forever condemned for that. But my own view of the point of biography is that we shouldn't look up at people from the past adoringly, and we shouldn't look down on them condescendingly. But if we can look them in the eye, then we may be able to make judgments about them that illuminate our own time. What in the future will future generations look back and call us to account for? And I think that to some extent, that's the moral utility of history.
How extensive was his relationship with Sally Hemings?
It was the longest relationship with a woman in his life. It was from 1787 until he died, 1786 or so. Produced a number of children. The Hemingses were the only slaves who were freed upon his death. And Sally Hemings herself left Monticello and went to Charlottesville and lived largely unaccosted. Very much an open secret, if that's not too oxymoronic. Jefferson was embroiled in that disastrous and tragic dynamic where white planters took advantage, to say the least, of African-American slaves. And it was a world of desire and denial. And it's remarkable when you go back and you read the diaries of the time and you find the hints. One diarist said that any white plantation woman could tell you exactly who the parentage of mixed-race children were on every other plantation, but on their own, they seem to drop as if manna from heaven. And so it's an incredibly complex world. And my own view is that being self-righteous in retrospect is, as Arthur Schlesinger once said, easy, also cheap.
This relationship you're talking about, it lasted 40 years.
Yeah, well, until the day he died. Started in France. The other point about the Sally Hemings story that is not widely appreciated is Sally Hemings was Thomas Jefferson's wife's half-sister. So we don't know if there was a physical resemblance. There are no images of Sally Hemings. But it was an incredibly complex moment in time and history. And clearly, he valued her, and they were there was some kind of connection, as you say, for a biblical 40 years.
And his wife, Martha,
Yeah.
She died when Jefferson was 39 years old, didn't she?
That's right. That's right.
And he lived to be 83, or yeah, 83 years old. So all those years after his wife passed, he was involved with Sally Hemings.
The report is that Martha Jefferson, Patsy as she was known, Patty as she was known, extracted a promise from Jefferson not to marry again. I think it was less of a selfish request than an attempt to defend her own daughters. There were three daughters living at the time, because Mrs. Jefferson herself had had an unhappy experience with stepmothers. And so I think she was trying to protect the girls from that. But Jefferson was a virile, vigorous, appetite-driven man in the prime of his life, as you point out. And any man who had these remarkable appetites for power, for books, for wine, for food, for adventure, for architecture, for gardening, for agriculture, I mean, go on and on and on. I think it's silly to think that that appetite would somehow stop or be foreclosed from the most sensual experience available to human beings. And so those who deny the relationship, and there are still some who do, I think are just almost willfully misreading the biographical record.
The book is The Art of Power, Thomas Jefferson, from Pulitzer Prize winner John Meacham, who will be in New Orleans for an event this Friday at the Garden District Bookshop. And you'll be not so far away from where the Louisiana Purchase took place.
Exactly.
Certainly, exactly. Stephen Ambrose says that's Jefferson's crowning achievement.
It was, and it was an example of presidential power that endured. Both Franklin Roosevelt and Abraham Lincoln looked back on the Louisiana Purchase in their moments of crisis for inspiration and example. Jefferson said of New Orleans, there's one spot on the earth which cannot be possessed by a foreign power, and that's New Orleans. He always appreciated, always understood the strategic and commercial importance of New Orleans, in the same way Andrew Jackson did, with whom I spent 4 or 5 years a couple of years ago. And so for some reason, all my subjects end up defending New Orleans. Which is a good thing. But I think that the Louisiana Purchase was the first great example of a president acting pragmatically against his off-stated philosophical convictions. You can argue that Washington and Adams had their moments, but for Jefferson, the idea that he would, in order to take advantage of this moment of weakness for Napoleon, when Napoleon offered it up, to move quickly, not to go to the country to ask its permission, which was his view of the Constitution at that point. You know, it's hard to remember sometimes. We live in a world where the president is the center of action, almost to the exclusion of Congress, which is actually kind of a good idea right now. But anyway, that's another topic. But Jefferson was, more than Adams, more than Washington, he put the presidency at the center of national action, which is a great irony because Jefferson was the one who was so eloquent about how power had to be kept close to the states and close to the people. But Jefferson never let philosophy get in the way of pragmatic duty.
Jefferson and John Adams, the second president, they died on the same day, July 4th, 1826. What a curious irony that is. And certainly their paths crossed, and sometimes not so pleasantly.
It's one of the great relationships in American politics. I guess, come to think of it, it's probably the great relationship in terms of a political and personal, at times alliance, at times rivalry. They first met in 1775. Adams was 8 years older, a much more experienced political figure, short-ish, about average height for the time. Jefferson was unusually tall for the time. Adams envied Jefferson, his fluidity with his pen, and a good bit of the personal charm. They were comrades during the Revolution. They served together as among our first diplomats. Then when Adams became the first vice president and Jefferson became the Secretary of State, their paths were, and Adams had a much more Federalist view of the way the country should move. Jefferson lived in a kind of existential terror about the British returning to take over the country, which people in Louisiana can appreciate because they did try once, as we know, in 1812, 13, 14, 15. And so they drifted apart over politics. There was always a level of quiet civility, as ferocious as the battles could be. And I think there's a lesson there. They ran against each other twice for president, which is not a way to create warm personal bonds. But when things calmed down a bit, when the fever of battle was over, they began one of the great epistolary correspondences in American history, exchanging, I think, about 180 letters late in their lives. And I commend that to folks to read those letters because they're philosophical musings. They're two old warriors. You know, it's like Priam and Achilles meeting in the tent on the plains of Troy.
Jefferson also had a complex relationship with his vice president, Aaron Burr.
Yes, to say the least, yeah. Andrew Jackson once said that his two regrets in public life were that he had not hung Henry Clay and shot John C. Calhoun, and Calhoun was his vice president. Jefferson, I think, felt the same way about Aaron Burr. You know, through a quirk in the Electoral College, you know, we had not quite worked everything out by 1800, 1801, Burr and Jefferson tied in the Electoral College. Now, Burr was understood to be the vice presidential candidate, but there was actually nothing in the Constitution that differentiated between votes for president and votes for vice president. So it was suggested to Burr when they received the same number of votes that Burr might want to make a play to become president. And it created a constitutional crisis in the January, February of 1801, an incredible moment of tension, talk about having a president pro tem installing either the president of the Senate or maybe John Marshall, who had just become Chief Justice, to be president for a time until they could resolve it. Burr would tell Jefferson, of course, I have no interest in this. I serve at your pleasure, but then never actually really declared that he was out of things. And so it took an extraordinary amount of work in the House of Representatives and then a constitutional amendment, the 12th Amendment to the Constitution.
Okay. John's phone line is acting up. So, JC, let's see if we can get him to a little better place. If we can, we'll resume the conversation as we close out the hour with this remarkable writer, John Meacham. He's in New Orleans, the biographer of Andrew Jackson, and now his target is Thomas Jefferson. And it is in paperback, the overwhelming best-selling book. It is The Art of Power from John Meacham, writing about Thomas Jefferson, who had feuds with his predecessor, John Adams, and with his vice president, Aaron Burr, who ultimately killed the Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, in a duel on July 11, 1804, in Weehawken, New Jersey. How did Jefferson respond to the duel between Burr and Hamilton?
Very quietly. It was one of those moments that disappointed me about Jefferson. I was looking for some sort of meditation, some sort of letter, something where Jefferson himself found a way to do what he and Adams did, which was to look beyond the crisis of the moment and create a sense that, well, we had disagreed strongly, but ultimately we we believed in the country itself. And there was nothing. Jefferson was silent on the question. And part of the reason for that was that Hamilton was a political... Hamilton's death was being used by New York politicians to create a great deal of Federalist sentiment. And so so Jefferson let us down on that.
Well, John Meacham hasn't let us down with his biographies of U.S. presidents in a city that he knows well by virtue of Jackson and Jefferson. That's where he'll be Friday at the Garden District Bookshop. We thank you for joining us today, John, and commend you for your exceptional work as a historical biographer of U.S. presidents.
Thank you, Jim.
Take care. And we'll be back tomorrow at the same time. For J.C. Kane, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, everybody, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.